This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Robbie Damelin and Mazen Farage both suffered deep losses in the fighting between Israelis and Palestinians. Robbie's son was an officer in the Israeli army. He was shot and killed by a Palestinian sniper. Mazen's father was a Palestinian laborer. He was shot and killed by Israeli soldiers while passing between Jerusalem and the West Bank. As survivors, they believe in channeling their grief into healing. They want to help others who share their pain in this conflict. They say they've given up revenge in favor of reconciliation. Robbie and Mazen traveled the country with a group called Parents Circle, part of Palestinian-Israeli Bereaved Families for Peace, and they're with me today on The State of Things. Welcome to both of you. It's good to have
Thank
you here.
Thank you.
Robbie, let me ask you first. Both of you, of course, have deep roots in this conflict. Tell me first how you came to Israel. You came from South Africa.
Well, I lived in South Africa during the apartheid days, and I knew that I wanted to leave because I very much was involved in the anti-apartheid movement. And then came the Six-Day War, and I felt the need, causes Bailey, to come and save Israel. So I ended up working in a chicken house on a kibbutz as a volunteer, and really never left. I'd planned to come and live in the States or in London, but landed up staying in Israel.
Tell us more about your son and his involvement. He was in the army.
David was a student at Tel Aviv University, and he was studying for his master's in the philosophy of education. And he was part of the peace movement and was head of the student uprising. Can't imagine where he got that from. And he cared very deeply and didn't really want to serve in the occupied territories. You know, there's such a quandary for young men who have to serve in the reserves. He'd finished his military service. He could, as with many, many other Israeli kids, he would have to serve in reserves. And when he was called up, he came to talk to me because he didn't want to serve in the occupied territories. But he had students who were going to be inducted into the army. And he also was the officer, so he didn't want to let his soldiers down. And he said, if I go, I will treat people with dignity and my soldiers will have to as well. So, you know, people don't get it. They don't see who's behind the gun.
Well, it gets back to I'll call it a quandary, but some of the paradox. You talk about being in the anti-apartheid movement. That means having a heart for social justice and also feeling a deep love for Israel, feeling the need to come back, the causes belli, the reason to come back and defend what you considered your land, your country. These things aren't necessarily in conflict initially, right?
The whole of existence in Israel is always, for me, a love-hate relationship. Because I understand the absolute need for a Jewish state. And I love Israel. But I want Israel to be a moral country. And I don't think that we can claim to be moral or a light unto any nation until Palestine is free. And I think the freedom for the Palestinians and for them having a homeland is a basic human right. And so if we are intent on staying in Israel for any length of time without a Palestinian state, Israel would be a big question mark for the future.
Well, and so now tell us more about your son. As you say, he didn't have to. He was thinking about not serving, but if he didn't, then, you know, so someone else would be the officer over those men in the occupied territory or those other soldiers.
Well, you know, he could have actually got out of it if he really wanted mm-hmm. to. Many people do manage to get out. David was perhaps filled with a sense of duty and quandary and not knowing really what to do. Mm. And I look back and I think to myself, I remember that I met this Palestinian man a couple of years after he was killed by this sniper at the American embassy. And this man was looking at me all the time, Palestinian, and I knew he wanted to say something, but he was kind of too scared or embarrassed, I don't know. At the end, I got up and went to talk to him, and I said, what? And he said, look, I just want to tell you that the day before your son was killed, I drove through that checkpoint, and he came to the car, this very beautiful, very tall guy, and said, I have to check your papers. It's my duty. It's like paying income tax. And they got into a conversation, And he said, you know, when I heard your son was killed, this is a Palestinian. He said, I was really sorry. And that's the essence of all the work that we're doing, because that was he saw the humanity in David and vice versa. So that's more or less what goes on with everything that we do in the parent circle, is this recognition of the humanity of the other. And that opens up room for a conversation.
Mazen, let me talk with you. And first of all, talk about your upbringing. You had older brothers and you were brought up in the occupied territories. What was that like for you?
Actually, I don't know sometimes how to describe what it means to live under the occupation or to grow up and to born in a refugee camp. It's become kind of, this is our life and this is the normal life, which is, we don't know nothing else, because we grow up about the in a story of our Nakba, our catastrophe. When my father was 6 years old, he just expelled from there. And they just run from the fear and the death and the war and the violence, and they find themselves in a refugee camp.
This is 1948. You're talking about this catastrophe.
Yeah, 1948, and still this occupation killing our life as a Palestinians, our dreams, our thoughts, our thinking, and our future too. So this is actually how all this generation grow up. I grow up in this kind
Your brothers had all been arrested by the age of 15.
And then
you were arrested.
My brother was arrested in the age of 15, and also it was the same process. It was with me too. Mm. I was the first time in my life in a prison when I was 15 years old. So we just express ourselves. I remember very well that when I joined the first Intifada, everything that I know, I just want to say I'm a Palestinian. I'm exist. I'm a normal, I'm a human being. All these kind of things, I grow up with it. And today, if you see the next generation, it will be grow up in the same until we are finished all this incubation for the Palestinians.
Tell us how your father died.
And my father was coming back from Jerusalem to Bethlehem. And he was 62 years old. And all what he had in his hand, a few things for his family, for his children. And the Israeli army start shooting him and they kill him. In a very, very violent way, and then we received the phone call from the hospital in Bethlehem, and we've been under the curfew in our camp, and we went to the Israeli army to ask him to go to the hospital to see or to check what's happened to our father for the last time, and they just said it's not allowed, you have to wait until the morning, but really I cannot understand and cannot imagine anyone can wait all this long night and long hours. So my father was 62 years old. And when he was in age of 6, he expelled from his original village. He spent all his life as a refugee, without education, without school, without university. He spent all his life as a worker inside the Israelis, inside the Israel. He spent all his life to try to look for a better future for his children. He spent all his life visiting us in Israel jail, from jail to another. And he spent all his life as someone he dreaming about to come back to his original level or original life. So this is a story of my father, but I think and I'm sure you will find a lot of stories about a lot of Palestinians from the first or the second or the third generations.
What was your first reaction? What did you want to do when you heard your father was killed?
I don't know what to do with that. I don't know. It's taken me a lot of times to find the way, what I want to do. It takes me a lot of times to ask my questions, a lot of questions in my head. What's happened to him and why? Why? And all this memory with my father, I have to wake up in the next day in the morning and to continue the normal life, which is nothing normal anymore.
Robbie, what about you when you heard that your son was shot by a Palestinian sniper at that checkpoint? What was your first reaction?
Well, you know, the army comes to tell you. So, of course, there was a knock on the door, and the minute I saw them, they didn't have to tell me. And I tried to chase them away, apparently. And I'd run away from home very early in the morning because I must have had some feeling, because I spoke to David the day before, and he told me that he was in a very dangerous place. And it seems that one of the first things that I said is, you may not kill anybody in the name of my child. So I didn't know that, but I was told afterwards that that was what I said. There's nothing worse. You know, I'm a kind of fixer person, but I can't fix this. So it's a question of what you decide to do with all of this tremendous pain. You know, many families die with their child, maybe not physically, but they never function. Others build monuments and museums. And I knew that I wanted to do something that had to do with education, because that was really what I was commemorating in David's life. And I also knew very early on that that this man killed David not because he was David. He was in uniform, and he killed him because he was a symbol of the Israeli army. And that, in a way, was quite a realization, you know, and I wanted to do something to prevent other families, both Palestinian and Israeli, from experiencing this horrible pain.
Mazen, what drove you to the reconciliation movement?
First of all, I want to really to spread this message of about what's happened to my father or to my family or to my case as a Palestinian in a different way, in a non-violent way. I want to spread this message and these stories and this narrative to a different nation around the world, and especially for the Israelis. And suddenly I was invited to meet the Berlin Circle, the Brief Families Forum. And in that meeting, for the first time, I discovered the humanity of my enemy. And also I discovered a lot of humanity inside myself after all what's happened to me as a human being. And since that time until now, I devote my life to this message or to this mission, and I devote my life to that, to try to change the situation or to try to build a new situation, a better future for the next generations by education, by learning, by dialogue, by understanding, by something that you can give a new tools for the people to use. It's not about to give up. It's not about to normalize with the incubation. It's about a new tools to fight this incubation.
What you say suggests what I've heard you say before, which is this is not strictly about forgiving and forgetting. This reconciliation is far deeper than that. That includes not giving up on the project, but as you say, new tools. How does this work, though? What is it about reconciliation? Why is that more effective than simply taking up arms against what is patently unjust and shooting it out of the way?
It's because our case as a Palestinian, it's about justice. It's not about killing. It's not about violence. And you know what? I cannot forget what's happened in my life. But also, I don't have the right to forgive what's happened to my father. But in the middle, I can find the way how we can build a better future for that. In the middle, we can find the new tools and the new method of dialogue, understanding. And we can find the way in the middle, again, the tools how to end this conflict, but in one condition: to do this with a full respect with each other and to each other.
And Robbie, I think you have a story about actually sending a letter to the man who ultimately was caught and who we think killed your son. You sent him a letter, and I think this is a good illustration of how reconciliation doesn't always come out the way you might expect it to.
In the beginning, when they hadn't caught the sniper, it was a lot easier for me to do this work because nobody put me to the test. You know, when there was no face, then I could go around the world feeling very pleased with myself about talking about shalom, salam, peace, love, all that stuff. But nobody ever put me to the test, really. I mean, yes, it's true that I lost my child, of course, but there was no face behind this. But when they caught him, that became a very, very difficult time for me because there was no integrity for me to work if I wasn't willing to walk the talk. So after about 3 months of not sleeping very well, to say the least, I wrote a letter to the family. And they were very surprised to get this letter from two Palestinians delivered it. But what it was, much more, was a release for me. Because the minute I wrote that letter, I gave up being a victim. And when you're a victim, you can't move forward. You know, your life is totally stuck and your life is contingent on the repentance, perhaps, of the other side. But as you go along, this is a very long process, you know. It's not instant reconciliation. It's a lot of testing to see if you're honest. And so in the letter, I told his family about David and who he was, and I asked them if they would be willing to meet, because I think we owe it to our children and grandchildren. It took a while, some few years, and I got a letter back, not exactly from Martin Luther King, I might say, from the sniper, to said that I'm mad and I should stay away from his family. But of course I knew, and that he killed 10 people, because 9 other people along with David, to free Palestine. But I knew that he'd seen his uncle very violently killed by the Israeli army when he was a child. And he lost 2 uncles in the second uprising. So he went on a path of revenge, you know. And the understanding why brings a lot of solace. That might sound strange to you, but it does. And then I went to South Africa to look at the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and to see what lessons we could learn for us. It's not that South Africa is Israel and Palestine. Of course not. But there were lessons to be learned. And when you were talking about forgiving, I'd been looking for a definition of forgiving for a very long time. I tried it in various religions and nothing really was meaningful. It's a very personal thing. You can't say that everybody sees forgiving with the same, through the same eyes or feeling. And I met this extraordinary woman who had lost her daughter. A white South African woman was killed by APLA, which was the military wing of the African National Congress. And she had gone to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and she said, "I forgive you," to the people who killed her daughter. I wanted to know what she meant. So I went to meet her and we made this film. It's called One Day After Peace. And she said, I asked her what her definition of forgiving was. And she said, forgiving is giving up your just right to revenge. And then I met the man who actually sent the people to kill her daughter. Together they have an organization today. She's my sister now. And he said that by her forgiving, she had released him from the prison of his inhumanity. And I thought that was the most extraordinary statement.
Are you optimistic about the prospects of this? Because you've made a case for how deeply personal this is and how transformative it can be if you take on this journey honestly. But public policy is also a very big part of this, and there are some players who have agenda that we can't even begin to understand who have a lot of influence in what happens in that part of the world.
Look, the point is that we cannot give up hope. I mean, I look at my grandchildren's eyes. How can I not continue to work? But more than that, I mean, when I first came to Israel, after all the days of South Africa, the anti-apartheid, where all the white people benefited from it, including me, even if I was in the anti-apartheid movement, if you would have told me in those days that blacks and whites would sit together in the same room and not want to kill each other, I would have said you were mad. And so a certain miracle happened in South Africa. It's no Garden of Eden now, but it takes time. People want the instant reconciliation. It's not going to happen. And by the way, I mean, even when I'm being here in America and looking at the fear factor that there is, it's very obvious here at the moment. That is the worst thing, because if you're fearful, it stops you from acting. And that's what brings violence. And so, no, there's no way I can give up hope.
Mazen, clearly you're still engaged in this, so I would have to think you are optimistic. Tell me why.
It's kind of, we are in a competition with the political level. We are doing everything to convince them and to convince our two society, the Palestinian and Israelis, there is another way. Don't believe them a lot. Try to listen to them, but also please try to listen to our message and our work on the ground. I'm optimistic just because one reason. The other way, it's more complicated and more violent and more people will get killed. And our way, and what we choose to do in our life, it's give me the reason to wake up in the morning and to see the things with my 3 daughters and to see their eyes, how much they are sometimes scaring. It's give me also the energy and the power to continue.
I want to thank you both for being on the program. Mazen Faraj and Robbie Damelin are members of a group of Palestinians, a group I should say is the Parent Circle, which is a Palestinian-Israeli bereaved families for peace. It's part of that organization, and I want to thank both of you for being on the program today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Just ahead, we're going to talk about the history of moonshine in North Carolina. Please stay with us.